So let's go then to the final chapter of the unit, which is about the spinal cord and the spinal nerves. Now, remember that the overall nervous system is broken into central nervous system and peripheral nervous system, and you might think that it would make more sense to study the central nervous system, brain and spinal cord together without the peripheral nervous system, and then go on to the peripheral nervous system. Instead, though, we're going to study part of the central nervous system and part of the peripheral nervous system, spine and spinal cord and spinal nerves together, and then separately study the other part of the central nervous system, the brain, and the other part of the peripheral nervous system, the cranial nerves. And the reason it makes sense to do that is because functionally they are so intimately connected. The spinal cord and the spinal nerves are continuous, and they function together. Of course, the spinal cord and the brain function together as well, but it makes sense to study them this way. The spinal cord, by the way, which of course is part of the central nervous system, connects to the brain, but the official boundary between the two is right at the large hole in the base of the cranium. What is that large hole called? Foramen magnum, yes. Which literally means big hole. So where the brain stem extends through that foramen magnum, on the other side of it, that's the beginning of the spinal cord. And the spinal cord then descends through the cavity that's formed by all of the vertebral foramina combined, right? I shouldn't say all of them, because the spinal cord doesn't make it all the way down. But the spinal cord is in that cavity that's formed by all of these individual vertebral foramina, all right? Notice that there is C1 through 7, T1 through T12, and so on being listed here. There are cervical spinal nerves, thoracic spinal nerves, lumbar spinal nerves, sacral spinal nerves, and a coccygeal spinal nerve, which is CO1. We can't use C1 for coccygeal because C is already taken by cervical. So the spinal cord has... I mean, the spinal nerves follow the terminology or the alphanumeric abbreviations that the spinal column does, the bones, but there isn't a match-up. What I mean by this is that the spinal nerve L5, you do not find that connecting to the spinal cord at bone L5. So there are segments to the spinal cord itself, not actually structurally, but we name them in segments. All right? Segments are named for the spinal nerve that connects to that segment. And those are what are called T1 through T12 and so on. Those are segments and spinal nerves both. But they don't match up with the bones because the spinal cord only extends to somewhere between bone L1 and bone L2. All right, so you can see it starting up there where it meets the brain. The spinal cord itself ends right where this thick yellow structure starts, up where the brown ends. So the spinal cord does not go all the way through this vertebral canal. I mean vertebral, all the canal formed by all the vertebrae. But spinal nerves come off of the spinal cord as you descend down the spinal cord. And there are spinal nerves for all of the bony sections. It's just that they come off the spinal cord, some other bone, and then descend before they come out. Now, the very tip, the inferior tip of the spinal cord, and therefore the inferior tip of the overall central nervous system, is the pointed end of the spinal cord, which is called the medullary cone. Medullary cone because it comes to a point. Okay, so the bottom of that medullary cone is where the spinal cord officially ends. The yellow things are not spinal cord. All of the yellow things are spinal nerves. And why does it make sense, based on something I've already told you, that spinal nerves are not part of the spinal cord? Well, it doesn't make sense because there aren't any nerves in the central nervous system, right? Spinal cord is part of the central nervous system, brain and spinal cord. But there aren't any nerves in the central nervous system. Remember those four definitions I gave you the first day for this? What is a nerve? All right, without looking, who can at least tell me the four terms? Nerve is one of them. Tract. Nucleus. And ganglion. Correct. Which two are analogous? Nerve is analogous to what? Tract. And ganglion is analogous to nucleus. Okay, so what's the difference between a nerve and a tract? They are both bundles of axons. But a nerve is a bundle of axon in the peripheral nervous system. A tract is a bundle of axons in the central nervous system. A ganglion and a nucleus are similar as well. They're both clusters of cell bodies, or neurosomas, but a ganglion is a cluster of cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system, whereas a nucleus is a cluster of cell bodies in the central nervous system. So based on those definitions, there aren't any nerves in the central nervous system. There are tracts, not nerves. And what is shown in yellow here, not the brown, but the yellow, are spinal nerves because they're all part of the central nervous system. They're not, they connect directly to the spinal cord. That's why they're called spinal nerves. But they're not actually part of the spinal cord. It's where the branch actually begins. Okay? So, inferior to... Well, before I say that, let me say that along the way, there are two places where the diameter of the spinal cord is a little bit enlarged compared to where the diameter in other parts. One of those occurs in the neck, right away, as you see. That's called the cervical enlargement. Pretty self-descriptive. It's wider there, the spinal cord, because there have to be more neurons that branch off of it at that point in order to serve the upper limbs. Similarly, there is a lumbar enlargement, greater diameter there because there need to be more neurons there coming out as spinal nerves to serve the lower limbs. Okay? Then you get to the very bottom of the spinal cord officially, which is that tip of the medullary cone, like I said, or conus medullaris, as some books will call it. Notice that it starts getting yellow there, so you're no longer in the spinal cord, but you have a bunch of neurons coming from the spinal cord directly connected to it, and also in that same canal that the spinal cord itself is in, it's just no longer officially the spinal cord, all of those neurons or fibers making up that part collectively are called the cauda equina. Caudus means tail. Horses are equines. Right? Equestrian means of horses. So the cauda equina literally means the horse's tail because it looks like long strands of a horse's tail. It's actually encased by the vertebrae. So this is a cutaway view all the way down, because you wouldn't see this normally, of course. The vertebrae wrap all the way around it. But then the cauda equina send off extensions of themselves that come out through intervertebral foramina. That's where you find spinal nerves coming out from the vertebral column. They exit the vertebral column through intervertebral foramina. The intervertebral foramina are the holes that are formed. A half of a hole is formed by one vertebra, and a half of a hole is formed by the vertebra below it, so that it's an opening toward the side. That's where spinal nerves come out. Okay? On the close-up view on the right, well, I should say before I get there that you also have a terminal phylum, which is a connective tissue band that holds this thing in place, basically. Extends from the tip of the cauda equina down to the bottom bone. So it just holds things in place. It's not excitable tissue. All right, when we look at the close-up on the right, we can see the meninges. Meninges is a plural term. Anyone know what the singular of meninges is? Meninx, correct. M-E-N-I-N-X. Is the singular of meninges, M-E-N-I-N-G-E-S. Similarly, phalanx was the singular for a digit bone, and phalanges was the plural. Meninx and meninges. So there are three meninges. These are layers that wrap around the central nervous system, both brain and spinal cord, but now we're only talking about the spinal cord. And they have separate names, of course. Working superficially to deep, they are the dura mater, which some people say mater. You can see the dura mater right here. The intermediate meninx, the one that's between the other two, is the arachnoid mater. And then the deepest one, which means the one that's right against the spinal cord, is the pia mater. Now, what does mater mean? Alma mater, or alma mater, is literally means nourishing mother. You know, that's the college that you first graduate from is your alma mater, your nourishing mother. Mater means mother. Dura mater means tough mother, because the dura mater is by far the thickest of the three meninges. Very thick, fibrous connective tissue that is protective, of course. The arachnoid mater is so called because it has a web-like appearance, and arachnoid means spider-like. It's really not like a spider. It's like the spider's web, so it really should be called gossameric rather than arachnoid, but I don't name these things. And then the pia mater means the tender mother, because that's the one that is hugging the spinal cord. It's actually connected directly to it. Now, the pia mater is also the thinnest, and you can't really easily tease away the pia mater. You'll just see it, if you do a real dissection, as kind of a glistening surface of the actual spinal cord and brain as well. The dura mater is easy to spot. It's tough stuff. It looks like a gray sheet of plastic. And then the arachnoid mater is actually connected to the inner surface of the dura mater. All right, so there really is no space between dura and arachnoid matera, which is the plural of mater. But there is a space outside of the dura mater, but still inside the spinal column, So inside the bone, but outside the dura mater, there is a space. And that is called the epidural space, because it's around the dura, or over the dura, I should say. Epi means over. Like I said, there's no space between dura and arachnoid, but there is then a space between the arachnoid and pia mater, and that's called the subarachnoid space, descriptively enough. And then there's no space between the pia and the actual spinal cord because it's right on the surface of the spinal cord. We'll see detail of that in other pictures, like slide 2. On the top picture, one thing I want you to notice is that, because a lot of people get this mixed up in their heads for some reason, a vertebra has a body, right? That's the load-bearing part. And then it has a ring of bone coming around from that body and then joining the body again. That's what forms the vertebral foramen. Well, that body, that load-bearing part, is in the front. The nose of the giraffe, or the nose of the moose, depending on whether you're on a thoracic or a lumbar vertebra, that is facing your back. The body of the vertebra is in front of your spinal cord. Notice that anterior is listed on the bottom of this top view of a vertebra. All right, and the spinal cord, you can see they're in cross-section inside the vertebral foramen. Now, the spinal cord is made up of two conspicuously different appearing tissues, gray matter and white matter. You also have gray matter and white matter in the brain, but the arrangement in the brain is opposite that in the spinal cord. In the spinal cord, as you see, white matter is superficial to the gray matter. Gray matter is deeper. It's surrounded by white matter. It's just the opposite in the brain. But we'll talk about the brain when we get to that chapter. All right. Why? What is the difference, though, no matter whether it's brain or spinal cord, what's the difference between gray and white matter other than the color? Well, what is it that gives it the white matter its color? Myelin. Correct. So white matter is made up of a bunch of myelinated axons. Since we're talking about the spinal cord, what kind of cells make up those myelin sheaths? That's not a cell type. We're talking about the spinal cord. We're talking about white matter, so there's myelin. What is providing that myelin? Oligodendrocytes, correct. Because myelinated axons in the peripheral nervous system get myelinated by Schwann cells or neurolemmocytes. All right, so that's what white matter is. Almost entirely myelinated axons. The gray matter doesn't have that whiteness because it is mostly cell bodies and also unmyelinated axons. Now, the cell bodies could be for the cell bodies of neurons that are either myelinated or unmyelinated, because cell bodies aren't myelinated either way. Right? But along with those cell bodies can also be unmyelinated axons, which also don't provide the whiteness that we have in white matter. And so, in cross-section, the dark matter... The gray matter, most people say is kind of in the shape of a butterfly. I don't see that at all. To me, it looks like a moth. But similar. The connection between the spinal cord and the spinal nerves, notice, occurs both in the front and the back, anteriorly and posteriorly. So a single spinal nerve is first of all paired. There's a left version and a right version. But if you confine your attention to just one side, that single right spinal nerve connects both dorsally and ventrally to the spinal cord itself. And that connection is still inside the vertebral foramen. So you wouldn't see that unless you cut away the bone. That is hidden within that, encased by the spinal column. Those two connection points, though, which are called rootlets, actually, I say there's two places where there's connections, but there are several little connection points ventrally and several dorsally. Those are called rootlets, 6 or 8, somewhere around there, per individual spinal nerve, on 6 in the front, 6 in the back. Those rootlets then converge into a bigger single root, so there's an anterior and a posterior root, or a dorsal root and a ventral root. And then the two roots combine into the largest single part, which is the very beginning of the spinal nerve itself. All right? And that convergence of the two roots to form the spinal nerve is also, notice, occurring right about where the intervertebral foramen is. So you don't really see the roots either unless you look inside where the bone encases it. Right where the intervertebral foramen is, that I showed you, that formed by two vertebrae coming together, that's where the two roots inside finally become the spinal nerve, and that's why you see only one rope-like spinal nerve coming out of that intervertebral foramen. Now, the spinal cord also has a central canal in it, which is a hollow structure. It's a hollow structure that's continuous with hollow structures in the brain called ventricles that we'll mention more about later. I say it's hollow meaning that it's not made up of neurons, but it's not empty. It's filled with cerebrospinal fluid. Now, the cerebrospinal fluid that's in the central canal and the ventricles is also continuous with cerebrospinal fluid that fills the subarachnoid space. So the space between the arachnoid mater and the pia mater, that subarachnoid space, is also filled with cerebrospinal fluid. And while I'm at it, I should say that the epidural space, which is the space between, it's outside of the dura, but it's still inside the vertebral foramen. So between the bone and the dura mater, you have mostly fat, but also blood vessels and some loose connective tissue. So you can see fat in epidural space labeled up there in yellow. That's mostly fat cells. The subarachnoid space is labeled below that, shown in blue there. And all three of these meninges, go all the way down the spinal cord. They cover it, the whole thing. But to keep the three layers from moving with respect to each other, and to keep one of them from getting bunched up, kind of like a sock in a pant leg, there are what amount to little spot welds here and there along the length, where the pia mater forms a direct connection through the arachnoid mater and connects directly to the dura mater. So the arachnoid mater is pierced here and there by a connection between pia and dura mater. And they're literally like little spot welds. They hold it in place and keep the three meninges from bunching up. All right, now we get a good view of the rootlets here becoming the roots on the bottom. and then the roots becoming the nerves. But in this view, we've removed all the bone. So that's why I was trying to say that all of this stuff that happens over to this point where the roots converge, that's actually inside the vertebral foramen. We just removed the bone so that you can see it more easily. And you get a good view of the individual meninges here. The red dura mater has been peeled away from the grayish-blue arachnoid mater, which is superficial to the pink pia mater that's right on the surface of the spinal cord. You don't really see the subarachnoid space in this bottom view, but it's between the pink and the bluish-gray, and that's where you would have cerebrospinal fluid. Cerebrospinal fluid is so named because it's found in the cerebrum, part of the brain, and the spinal cord. And it's really important for a couple reasons. It, especially in the brain, acts as a shock absorber. Jostling your brain around in your head would be much more injurious if it weren't for the ventricles filled with cerebrospinal fluid. But it also circulates things just like blood does. Nutrients get circulated to nearby tissues via the flow of cerebrospinal fluid. It's not a flow, though, like blood that is actively pumped by a pump like the heart. What moves cerebrospinal fluid around is the fact, well, body movements help, but also it's continuously, new stuff is continuously being produced. So you're adding to it continuously at the ependymal cells that produce it. And then older stuff is continuously being drained and put into the blood. So you always have fresh cerebrospinal fluid, and that's what also circulates it. More about that when we look at the brain, too. Let's go to 3 and talk about some specific pathways. These are called spinal tracts. Now that phrase by itself tells you that we're in the spinal cord, right? Not in spinal nerves. They're tracts because they are in the central nervous system. And notice overall that this table is broken down into ascending tracts and descending tracts. Ascending means, these words are in reference to the flow of information. So an ascending tract is so called because information is going up the spinal cord. A major function of the spinal cord is to serve as a connection between the peripheral nervous system and the brain. Now there are also some direct connections between the peripheral nervous system and the brain. Those are the cranial nerves. But spinal nerves can send information to the spinal cord, which then conducts that information to the brain. At least some of the information. The spinal cord, though, also does a fair amount of integration, just like the brain does, just not as deeply. You don't do any deep thinking with your spinal cord, but you do neural integration with your spinal cord, especially for reflexes. You know, when you step on the tack, you don't have to feel that. You eventually will. But you don't have to feel it before you start moving your foot away. Because that information only has to go to the spinal cord and then back to the muscles that get you the hell off of the tack. And then, after that has occurred, without you even realizing it, that information travels up the spinal cord to the brain and you process the sensation of pain. So it's a major thoroughfare of information, the spinal cord is, in both directions, though. If information is going upward, though, toward the brain, then that information is sensory information. It's incoming information, and therefore it's afferent, which is why you see ascending tracts being called sensory. Descending information, information flowing down the spinal cord, is coming from the brain, and it's going to leave the spinal cord through spinal nerves and go to some part of the body. That, therefore, is not sensory, it's motor. That information is either going to cause some muscle to contract or some gland to secrete. The major effector organs, remember, are muscles and glands. And by muscle, I don't necessarily mean skeletal muscle. It could be skeletal, smooth, or cardiac muscle. Or some sort of gland secreting. So that's why the descending tracts are called motor. And you can see that there are, this isn't an exhaustive list of the tracts, but these are the biggies. There are several big ascending tracts, several big descending tracts. And notice something about the wording of these things. A couple of them are called fasciculi, and that's because the spinal cord is made up of columns, which are called funiculi. Those are large subdivisions. And then within those funiculi, you have subdivisions called fasciculi, kind of like in the cross-section of a whole muscle. Just don't confuse funiculus with fasciculus. A funiculus contains several fasciculi. A funiculus is bigger, in other words. Funiculus and column mean the same thing. So gracile, that's a word that means thin. Cuneate means wedge-shaped. That's why they get their names. But the rest of them, notice, are spinothalamic, spinoreticular, spinocerebellar. Those words show you the flow of information. So if you can't remember whether they're ascending or descending, think about what spinothalamic means. Sending information from the spinal cord to the thalamus of the brain, spinothalamic. And therefore, that's ascending information, and therefore sensory. Spinoreticular goes from the spinal cord to the reticular formation, another part of the brain. And spinocerebellar goes from the spinal cord to the cerebellum, major subdivision of the brain. Okay? So think about these words in case you don't remember whether they're ascending or descending. On the descending ones, notice how these words are arranged. Corticospinal, tectospinal, reticulospinal, vestibulospinal. Spinal comes last in all those words. That's because the information is coming from some part of the brain and going to the spinal cord. Therefore, it's descending and motor. The corticospinal, both parts of it, lateral and anterior, corticospinal gets its name because the information is coming from the cerebral cortex, which is the part of the brain that actually gives it the classic brainy appearance, the wrinkles. That's the cerebral cortex. That's where your deep thinking is occurring, assuming you think deeply. And tectospinal comes from a part of the brain called the tectum, which we'll look at later, that means roof. Reticulospinal comes from the reticular formation and goes to the spinal cord. Reticular formation is another part of the brain. And then finally, vestibulospinal, named for the fact that the information originates in a tract called the vestibular tract. The vestibular tract gets its name because it's receiving information from the vestibules of the inner ear. The vestibules are the parts of the ear that are responsible for the sense of balance. Ear is a dual sense organ. It's for hearing, audition, and also balance. The balance part is performed by semicircular canals of that inner ear. Well, the information that they're collecting is sent through the vestibular tract and down to the spinal cord, and therefore it's vestibulospinal. So those words hopefully will remind you of which direction the information is traveling. Now, if we look at the third column that is listed as decussation. Decussation refers to crossing over. And I don't mean crossing over in the genetic sense, in case you know what that is. Crossing over means going from right to left within the central nervous system. Now, decussation can occur in the brain, or it can occur in the spinal cord. But it literally means crossing over. And a neuron, as it makes its way, you know, a long neuron, part of that neuron is going to be situated on the left side and the other part on the right side. So to get from left to right or from right to left, it has to cross over the midline. That is decussation. Now, information is traveling through individual neurons, right? When we talk about nerves, it's not a neuron. Nerve and neuron do not mean the same thing. A nerve is a bundle of many, many, many individual neurons. But that bundle can be a one-way street in either direction, or it can be a two-way street. Usually it's a two-way street, meaning that there are some of those fibers or neurons that are in that nerve are carrying information in one direction, some of them are carrying information in the other direction. In other words, some of them are sensory and some of them are motor. But even in a so-called mixed nerve, which is one the usual case when there's both sensory and motor neurons, any individual neuron, no matter what kind of nerve it's in, is carrying information in only one direction, right? Direction always proceeds from ganglion to ganglion end to axon end, or from cell body to axon end. Not in the reverse. You can get it to fire in the reverse, but you have to actually zap it with electricity to do that. So back to this decussation word. These tracts, by definition, are bundles of axons. But they're in the central nervous system. That's why we're no longer calling them nerves. And so these axons that make up a tract are traveling either up or down in terms of flow of information, or traveling either up or down the spinal cord to get to the brain or to come from the brain. And if they don't decussate, in other words, if they connect to the brain on the same side as they remain in the spinal cord, then we say that the information they're carrying is ipsilateral, which literally means on the same side. I-P-S-I, lateral, all one word. The opposite of that is contralateral. Contra meaning against. So contralateral information is carried by neurons that decussate. And this is why brain activity in the left side affects the right side of your body, and vice versa. Or something that, you know, if you feel something touching your right side, first of all, that feeling, which is sensation, is, even though it might feel like it's happening at that part of your body, the feeling, the sensation, is occurring in your brain. That's high-level processing after it's already gotten that input. But the activity in your brain that gives you the sensation of feeling something on your right side occurs on the left side of the brain because it's it's contralateral fibers that carry that sensory information in most cases. But notice on the decussation column that some of these tracts decussate, most of them do, some of them don't. If there's not decussation, then it's going to be ipsilateral information. If there's decussation one time, then it's going to be contralateral information. There are some instances in which it's actually two decussations, one that happens in the spinal cord, and then later on it decussates again in the brain. Two crossings over is really functionally the same as not crossing over at all, right? So that's still going to end up being ipsilateral. Go from right to left and then back to the right. But anyway, that's what that column refers to. And then we have various functions. Notice that all the ones for the ascending tracts are sensory functions, and there are different kinds of sensory information, different kinds of touch even. Light touch, deep touch, discriminate touch. Those are carried by different fibers to different parts of the brain. Pain. Also proprioception, notice, listed toward the bottom of that list. Proprioception is sensory information. But it's not necessarily sensory information that results in sensation. Remember, I said the difference between sensory and sensation is that sensation is the event that happens in the brain that gives you the awareness of something. There's sensory, visual sensory information that comes in starting at your eyeballs, but you actually don't see until you create the sensation of vision based on that input. Well, similarly, you have proprioception, which is sensory information about the positioning of your limbs and other body parts. You don't have to be looking at your limbs to be able to know where they are in space, right? So there is some sensation, but often you kind of you put out of your mind the sensation. You kind of have to think about it to feel where your limbs are. Usually, your brain is just aware of it and it's making important calculations so that you have correct posture and don't fall over, even if you're not really continuously aware of where all your body parts are. But that's proprioception, that incoming information about where you are positioned in space is coming through as part of these ascending tracts, these sensory tracts. And the motor ones control various effector organs, and we'll look at some examples of both of these. Slide 4. This cutaway view of the spinal cord, I first of all want you to realize that what's shown in red on one side and green on the other side, both of those occur on both sides symmetrically. Just for simplicity, we're putting the ascending tracts in red on one side only and the descending tracts in green on the other side only. But they're paired, of course. Okay? So the ascending tracts are sending information to the brain. Descending tracts are relaying information from the brain. The ascending information, the afferent or sensory information that is going to be sent to the brain, is first received by the spinal cord through spinal nerves that connect, to the spinal cord. And remember that there are these two roots to each spinal nerve, the ventral and the dorsal root. Well, the roots are one-way streets in terms of flow of information. Each root is. The dorsal root on both sides, so the left dorsal root of that spinal nerve and the right dorsal root of that same named spinal nerve, the dorsal roots carry only sensory information. So you touch yourself on the front, you can feel that, of course, because your brain processes that sensation, but the information to get to the brain, even though you're touching the front of your body, goes into the spinal cord through the back of it. It's traveling through a dorsal root. The ventral roots, which are of course in the front, carry only motor information. So you make a part of your body in the back of your, on the back surface, move. That information is still coming out the front in order to get to that muscle. All right? But where the two roots come together, that's where the spinal nerve is. The spinal nerve as a whole is a two-way street, carrying both afferent, or sensory, and efferent, or motor information. You can see that there are three major columns. I talked about columns or funiculi a little bit ago. There are three major pairs of columns in each little section of spinal cord. So there's a posterior column, a pair of columns, where the two are labeled right there. Gracile and cuneate fasciculi make up the posterior column. Same thing on the other side. There is a lateral column to the side, of course, which is what lateral means. And there's an anterior column, which is why the spinal thalamic and spinal reticular tracts are members of what we call the anterolateral system, because it's kind of between all the way to the front and all the way to the side, anterolateral. But there is a lateral column, an anterior column, a lateral column, and a posterior column. Okay, now let's look at some specific tract examples. Slide 5. What we're looking at on the left in part A is the cuneate fasciculus, which, as you see by the red arrows, is an ascending tract, but you notice you'll find that cuneate fasciculus name within the ascending tracts on that table I showed you. And one thing I didn't mention about the dorsal roots of the spinal nerves is that they are much wider in diameter than the ventral roots. And that's because the dorsal roots feature what are called dorsal root ganglia. Each dorsal root has a ganglion. And what's a ganglion? Not axons, no. What did you say? Yeah, a ganglion is a cluster of cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system. Well, you're still in the peripheral nervous system because it's not yet in the spinal cord. And so it's called a dorsal root ganglion because that's where the cell bodies of these sensory neurons are. All right? So this is the cell body. The red part that is running all the way through the spinal nerve, whatever spinal nerve that is, that ends somewhere in the body, or really, it's more correct to say it begins somewhere in the body in terms of flow of information. So it could be a raw nerve ending that itself can fire in response to certain stimuli, or it could be connected to a sense organ that causes it to fire under certain situations. But in any case, a sensory neuron fires and sends that information through this long axon that eventually has an offshoot to a cell body as it continues on its way. So the cell body is kind of like a rest stop along the way of the axon. I showed you a picture of this in the first day. But all of those cell bodies, for all of these many individual neurons that make up that nerve, the sensory ones at least, are clustered together to make up that dorsal root ganglion. Same thing on the other side. You don't have a ganglion in the ventral root because the cell bodies of the motor neurons are in the spinal cord themselves. And therefore, where you find those clustered together, they're not even called ganglia, right? They're called nuclei because it's in the central nervous system. So that's why you have the enlargement in the back. And that's, if you were to ever need to know which side is which, back or front, look for the ganglia. That tells you posterior, because it's the dorsal root ganglia. There are no ventral root ganglia. So anyway, this is an ascending tract, so it's carrying afferent information first to the spinal cord and then up the spinal cord to some part of the brain. Sensory information, no matter where it's coming from in the body, makes its way eventually to kind of a relay station in the brain called the thalamus. And that's where this information is headed. You can see the thalamus labeled in the brain in lavender. Now, there is one stretch of neuron all the way from wherever this thing begins in the body up to the spinal cord, somewhere in the spinal cord. All right? So that's a long neuron. But this sensory neuron, notice, comes in for the cuneate fasciculus, which is the specific tract we're looking at. The sensory neuron enters the spinal cord on whatever side the spinal nerve is on. And then notice it travels up the spinal cord until it gets to the medulla. So this next little slice next to the bottom, notice it's labeled as medulla. That's no longer spinal cord. That's part of the brain. The medulla oblongata is a part of the brain. So each of these pictures is shown as slices through different part of the central nervous system, part of the brain or different parts of the brain, and then also part of the spinal cord. But notice that this neuron is labeled as a first-order neuron, which can also be called a primary neuron. There are primary neurons, secondary neurons, and tertiary neurons, and in some cases even quaternary or fourth-order neurons. But most of them are made up of these three. This is the first-order neuron. The first-order neuron continues. It's long already just to get to the spinal cord, but then it goes all the way up the spinal cord length until it gets to the medulla, and that's where you see the end of it, the little triangular-shaped end that represents the axon terminal. It then synapses with the second order or secondary neuron. And notice that the secondary neuron decussates at the medulla. This agrees with the information in the table. So since it decussates, now the information is contralateral. This part right here is the front. So this would be this person's right, that this is coming in from. But now that information is being carried up the left side of the brain because of the decussation. And then it finally gets to the thalamus where the secondary neuron ends and synapses with the tertiary neuron that then sends that information up to the cortex, the cerebral cortex. And that's where higher level processing is done with respect to sensation of whatever this sensory input leads to. Now, a similar situation is happening on the right side, except that's the spinothalamic tract. And so it's just a little bit different arrangement of these neurons. The primary neuron comes in, same situation. You have its cell body in the ganglion, of course. But as soon as it enters the spinal cord, it ends, unlike the other tract on the left. So the secondary neuron starts right where it enters the spinal cord, and notice that is where it decussates as well. So it decussates in the spinal cord rather than in the brain. It's already contralateral, goes straight up to the brain at the thalamus, and then synapses with the tertiary neuron, which sends it to the what's called the somatosensory part of the brain, or in this case, in this book, it's called somesthetic. They mean the same thing. Slide 6. Well, by comparison, now we're looking at a motor tract. So notice the down arrows. And this is the corticospinal tract that I mentioned from the table. So it's carrying information from the cerebral cortex to the spinal cord. And once again, we have a serial arrangement of neurons. But in the case of descending tracts, usually it's just two neurons that we call the upper neuron and the lower neuron, rather than primary and secondary. The upper neuron, since this is downward flowing information, since it's efferent or motor, the upper neuron is carrying the information first, right? It's upstream. And so the upper neuron starts out with its cell body in the brain, in this case in the cerebral cortex, and then travels down. Notice that it is ipsilateral all the way down until you get to the medulla, which is still part of the brain, but it's the bottom of the brain. And then you have decussation in the medulla, but only for the dark part, which is the lateral corticospinal tract. The anterior one, even at the medulla, didn't decussate. All right? But then notice that later on, the anterior one in lighter green, it finally does decussate anyway. So even though they decussate at different places, both of these divisions of the corticospinal tract are carrying contralateral information because each one of them decussates. So by the time you get to the spinal cord, then the upper motor neuron ends and it synapses at the cell body of the lower motor neuron. And notice where that cell body is in both cases. The dark green cell body and the light green cell body are both within the moth. The gray matter, right? Why does that make sense? Well, we have a minute left for you to... Based on what I told you about 70 minutes ago, why does that make sense? It is true that the gray matter includes unmyelinated axons, but the reason it makes sense based on what I said is these are cell bodies. Cell bodies are not myelinated. Axons are. So the cell bodies that make up a nucleus, that's going to be gray matter, not white matter. All right, we'll end there.